I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to The Connection. Chances are you've seen the ads from FanDuel and DraftKings. They're hard to ignore.
Garbage time. That phrase never sounded quite right, because no part of football is meaningless. So while some folks see garbage, FanDuel sees treasure. We see spreads to cover, overs to hit, and chances to live bet from the first down to the final whistle. So don't just watch football this season, cherish it.
The tournament is pure chaos. Schools you've never heard of knocking out juggernauts, walk-ons hitting buzzer beaters, upsets every day. Nothing is guaranteed. Well, except for DraftKings rewards. They're serving them up every round. We're talking profit boosts, bonus bets, and more.
Since 2018, when the U.S. Supreme Court opened the door to sports gambling, betting on games has exploded to the tune of $160 billion last year. iPhone apps and micro-betting on specific plays and scores while the game is underway increase the chance of debt and addiction. Our guest, Harry Levant, got addicted to gambling the old-fashioned way, playing craps and blackjack. He got in so deep that he stole $2 million from his clients. In 2015, facing 13 counts of theft, he apologized to his victims and told the court he would make amends for what he had done. He sought treatment, works as a therapist and advocate, and is director of gambling policy with the Public Health Advocacy Institute at Northeastern University. He says gambling has never been so easy, which is why he is calling it a public health crisis. If you or anyone you know is having a problem with gambling, go to 1-800-GAMBLER. I should add that the Institute is part of a lawsuit accusing sportsbooks of using addictive methods to hook their users. And Harry Levant joining us here in our Philadelphia studios. Nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
It's my privilege. Thank you for the invitation.
You're very welcome. You started gambling when you were about 15 years old. Who introduced you?
My family. It was a Sunday morning thing, betting on football games. Mom, Dad, it was just part of what we did culturally as a family. It seemed innocent at the time.
And when would you say you got addicted?
I can still remember what it felt like to make my first bet. I think I was born a gambling addict. Gambling feels different to me. If you're asking when did things come off the rails, because with all addictions, left untreated, they don't get better over time. They get progressively worse. In late 2012, a lot of different things in my life were all going wrong at the same time. Any four or five of them I probably would have been able to handle, but I got up to about eight or nine different things, significant problems with anxiety and depression, and I reached for my drug of choice, which was blackjack table and dice at a craps table and sports betting. And my addiction just went to levels you never could have imagined.
So what did that feel like when you talk about drug of choice? Was it the excitement? Was it the money? Was it the people around you? Was it the sound of the casino?
Single biggest misconception about gambling disorder, people think it's about money. It has nothing to do with money. It has to do with the way the product and the action makes you feel. It is a euphoria you wouldn't wish on your worst enemy because it's entirely unsustainable. And the more you experience it, the more you want it. Round and round and round it goes. For someone who's struggling with gambling addiction, winning's worse than losing. When you're winning, you might have to stop. But when you're losing, there's more and more action to chase. I got caught into that. A switch flipped in my head, and there was nothing left of me. It owned my brain, my heart, my soul, my conscience, and it took me to a place you wouldn't wish on your worst enemy.
Some people describe it as a kind of a dopamine hit.
It's not kind of a dopamine
hit. It is a dopamine hit.
We have known scientifically since at least 2013, gambling addiction is an addiction on the same level as heroin, opioids, tobacco, alcohol, and cocaine. It is the dopamine, not the dough. We are talking about a full-fledged addictive product. Full stop scientifically.
So when you were in the throes of addiction, were you ashamed? Were you anxious? Were you even aware that you were addicted, or were you just chasing that high?
I was caught in a cycle of chasing the next high. Many mornings would start with me looking in the mirror, literally slapping myself in the face. Don't do this. Don't do this. Don't do this. You reach a level in a true pathological addiction of powerlessness. the addiction takes over. And when you talk about what you're chasing your next hit. You're chasing the next piece of high. And part of what happens is something we call tolerance. It takes more action to achieve that level of dopamine high. If I recall correctly, during my sentencing hearing, the sentencing judge commented, I was in the process of trying to kill myself the only way I really knew how. Wow. It was that pathological.
Did you keep it a secret? Did family, friends, did people know, first of all, what you were doing and how you were feeling about it?
You know who knew? The people who ran the casino knew. They were seeing me every
You're
day.
You're regular?
For 12, a regular and a big whale there 10, 12, 14 hours a day, four or five times a week. We call gambling disorder the silent addiction because it doesn't have any outward manifestations. Looking back, I think of the line from the Springsteen classic, Streets of Philadelphia. Yeah. I had become entirely unrecognizable to myself. But if you looked at me, you would have seen somebody still putting a suit and tie on every day. It's really quite frightening.
Did you hate yourself?
You know, one of the things I work on with my clients, who I'm privileged to treat now, is to find recovery. You have to find a place of forgiveness. You have to find a place of acceptance. You have to find a place devoid of that negative self-judgment. I hated everything that was happening, and I was powerless to stop it. I will never forget what I did. I own it. At the same time, I channel my energy, as I work with my clients to do, to channel my energy into something more meaningful, which is what I'm able to do in recovery.
I mentioned this, and you have talked about this before, which is that you stole something like you were working as a lawyer here in Philadelphia, stole something like $2 million from your clients, I guess from some of these lawsuits that they won. How were you able to convince yourself that you could both do it and, I guess, get away with it?
You're not thinking about it that cognitively. It when you're in the grips of addiction, you pathologically need your next hit. There was no moment where I woke up, not a single time. And what I'm about to tell you now is true for every client I've had the privilege to treat. Nobody wakes up in the morning and says, I know what I'm going to do today. I'm going to destroy my family. I'm going to destroy the relationships with the people who care about me and the people who trust me. That's what happens.
Right.
But that's not the intent. The intent is to get your next fix. We need, Marty, to help people. In order for people to overcome this, they have to have the ability to say those three courageous words, I need help. To help people get there, part of my job, my duty, is to reduce the stigma. People who are struggling aren't out there trying to hurt themselves or others. They are caught in the grips of a pathological addictive disease that takes them to a place they don't want to be. It's not about conscious thought.
Something must have happened, though. This was, what, 2014? You're in Atlantic City, I guess, trying to win back some of this money, and it sounds like something snapped for you.
Yeah, this is a really important time of year for me. This coming Monday, a couple of days after this show first airs, will be the 12-year anniversary of my last bet.
Good for you.
Thank you. And my failed suicide attempt. I tried to take my life. For me, not everybody in recovery has a moment of clarity, but I had an absolute moment of clarity. I was sitting at a desk in a hotel room in Atlantic City trying to write a note to say goodbye to my kids. Hmm. Write a note that would maybe explain that which could never be explained. And at that moment, I was trying to write the note. I was about to hang myself. I thought I was ready. And I had this moment of clarity. And again, my brain was gone. But I had this moment of clarity. I didn't want to die. My addiction wanted me to die. It would live on. I would be gone. And at that moment, I realized I didn't want that result. And I pick up the phone and call for help. And if I just may, the correlation between struggles with gambling addiction and risk of self-harm is greater than any other addiction. For anyone who hears me tell this part of the story, if you are struggling with thoughts of self-harm, dial 988, pound 988 on your phone. You're not alone. Recovery is possible. If you are thinking of harming yourself, please dial that number and seek help.
Indeed. Do you think, though, perhaps with the advantage of 12 years of hindsight, that it was the act of writing to your children that somehow got you to think twice about what you were thinking about?
I have no doubt that's where the clarity came from. I was trying to write a note I thought I was prepared to write. I thought I wanted to write that. I was done. There was nothing left of me. I was a shell, as I said earlier, unrecognizable to myself. But I think what happened, what brought me to that moment of clarity, was I didn't want to say goodbye to my kids. Yeah. And at that moment, I reached for that phone. And that was the first of a series of conversations that have fundamentally changed my life and brought me to this great moment to have the privilege of meeting you.
You called your brother, I understand it.
A brother and some friends.
Yeah. And what did you say?
There's a lot about that night I don't remember. I remember sobbing and screaming into the phone, I need help, I need help, I'm an addict, come get me. I remember very, very little of that night, but I do just remember screaming into the phone that I need help, I need help. And he sent two friends, two Philadelphia lawyers, who are friends of mine to this day.
This is your brother sending them.
Two friends of mine, Alan and Jim, who are friends of mine to this day. Mm-hmm. And they drove down to Atlantic City, came and got me and brought me back.
And where did you go from there?
A couple of days later, I went to rehab in Arizona. And when I came out of rehab, went to the Philadelphia District Attorney's office and self-reported what I'd been doing and began a series of months of telling them everything that I had done, turning all my records over and trying to slowly put the pieces back together. And also at the same time, found my way to a phenomenal addiction psychologist in Bala Cynwyd by the name of Jeremy Frank, and started working with Jeremy Frank individually and in intensive group therapy. Started going to GA and just started putting one small foot in front of the other. Got a job initially busing and then waiting tables at restaurants, and just decided that my singular goal each day was not to make a bet, and just slowly begin to take account of what I had done in the grips of my addiction.
We're almost up on a break here, but the district attorney's office must have been just floored to have someone come in a sense, confess your crimes.
I was more than happy to self-prosecute myself. I did all the things that I pled guilty to, and I own that. I did them in the grips of an addiction. That's where gambling addiction takes you to one or more of the following places: hospital, jail, morgue. That's what happens left untreated. We are talking about a public health crisis that is metastasizing right in front of our eyes.
Well, let's take that very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Harry Levant about how he developed a gambling addiction. I should add that he now works as a therapist and an advocate, director of gambling policy with the Public Health Advocacy Institute, and that's at Northeastern University. And we are talking about the problem of sports gambling and gambling itself. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Harry Levant. He's a problem gambler turned therapist, as he has been telling us, talking about how he fed his addiction by frankly stealing from clients, but also being at casinos day in and day out. And coming up, we'll be talking in some depth about sports betting and why he says it is a public health crisis. I do want to continue your story, Harry, because I think very few people can tell us what it's like to be addicted to gambling and also to get in on the other side, and then to talk about the challenges of living in this world that's surrounded by so many ways of gambling.
I'm happy to do it, but I first have to correct one thing you said.
Sure.
You described me as a problem gambler. I am a person with a gambling addiction, and I'm a person in recovery from gambling addiction. I struggle with the word problem gambler, and I'm going to tell you why. Sure. It's very stigmatizing. The problem is not with the gambler. The problem is with the product and how the industry and its sports partners target people with that product. when people realize they're struggling with an addiction, it is not a failure of morals or responsibility, they can begin to get help. So I like to refer to it as people who are struggling with gambling. Right. But when I call them problem gamblers, I like to correct that language because I think it's a little bit too stigmatizing.
I hear you. I feel, though, the need to also say that most people who gamble do not become addicted.
Completely agree. The overwhelming majority of people. Right. Are able to enjoy it recreationally. However, as we'll talk about in a little bit, the product is no longer designed in that way. It's designed to get people hooked on it with nonstop action. That's the problem from a public health standpoint. We'll talk about it more later.
Indeed, we will. Let me just pick up on a couple of things. And you did essentially go to court and apologize to the people that you had stolen money from, and you, in a sense, told the court, I'm going to turn my life around and make sure that they're not more Harry Levance that get drawn into this gambling addiction. How important was it to make an apology, to make amends, to do that part of your recovery?
I can't change the past, but I have a moral obligation to do everything I can to make amends now and moving forward in the future. And I very distinctly remember the day. It was February 13th, 2015, the day that I was sentenced. And I have a very clear recollection of what I said. I looked, after apologizing to my victims, I looked at the court and told the court, I have a binary choice. I can say that gambling addiction destroyed me. I can crawl away, never to be seen again. Or I can figure out how to dust myself off, look that monster in the eye, and figure out how to go back up to the top of that cliff and help prevent other people from falling off the cliff that I fell. I know the cliff's there. The word that I used that day, the key term was, I want to help prevent other people from suffering the same harm. And that was a vow I made on February 13th, 2015, and I'll do my best to honor that vow every day of my life.
What did you deal with in your therapy? And as you said, you had a wonderful therapist in Bala Cynwyd, and you've go to GA, but what has your, I guess, your recovery, what have you had to grapple with?
As with virtually all, I think all addictions, the gambling is the tip of the iceberg you see sticking out the top of the water. It wasn't the tip of the iceberg that sunk the Titanic. It's all the stuff underneath. And now I'm speaking now both from my own journey and what I do with my own clients. Gambling addiction is so severe for many people that the first thing you have to do is find a way to stop the hemorrhaging. You have to figure out, how are you going to be able to not make a bet today? A harm reduction model is not efficacious when it comes to gambling because it is everywhere. But once you have been able to build a little bit of stability and not gamble, for me, it was addressing the underlying anxiety, the underlying depression, the deeper sense of trauma that went back to my childhood, and then finding true authenticity, meaning, and purpose in this journey of recovery. How can I take the tragedy that happened? How can I take the pain that I caused to so many other people and myself and turn it into something that will be meaningful, not only to me, but allow me to authentically help others with a deep sense of purpose?
I read a sentence in a description about you about, quote unquote, unresolved father-son issues with your dad. Without going deep into that, but I think it's important. These early relationships are so important. Well, can you tell us about that?
I mentioned to you earlier that there were 8 or 9 things that all went wrong around the same time. Shortly before my gambling went off the rails, I had lost my father. My father was a phenomenal Philadelphia trial lawyer. And we had as many father-sons do, particularly those who choose to follow in their father's footsteps, had a complicated relationship. And one of the areas where it was complicated was around gambling. We spent a lot of time gambling together.
Bonding. I mean,
their father-son bonding for us was around gambling. And it's one of the things I worry most about as an advocate today, because what we have done with sports, sports that historically were shared by grandparents and parents and children and siblings, we have turned them into a nonstop roulette wheel. There is bonding around. I lived that for decades, and it was somewhat, if not entirely, unresolved when my father passed away, and it was percolating in me. And when it came time for all these things to boil over, my drug wasn't marijuana.
Right.
My drug wasn't cocaine. My drug wasn't alcohol. My drug was gambling. And I was self-medicating a lot of pain. And, you know, it my father was a great father, a phenomenal lawyer, and a tremendous grandfather.
Yeah.
And also a very complicated person. And I know a lot more about that today than I did then.
How about your own family with your kids? As you said, it was writing this note that kind of woke you up to what was happening to you.
One of the things that we know about gambling addiction, for each person who struggles, 8 to 10 other people in their immediate orbit are also suffering harm. We never talk about that. The parents, the spouses, the partners, the siblings, the children are all getting hurt by this. It's why I have recently formed a new organization, or helped form a new organization called Families and Friends of Gamblers, FOG, F-F-O-G. And the website is hurtbygambling.org. It's going to become an advocacy organization for all the impacted others who want to bring about change, because these folks are overlooked. And my kids suffered tremendous harm, as did their mother, as did my clients. And that's part of what gambling addiction looks like.
Have you been able to talk to your children about that time in your life?
There's very few topics I don't talk about publicly. I don't talk about my children and my relationship with them,
sure,
because they're not here to speak for it.
Of course.
What I will tell you is that they're wonderful human beings who are doing really well, but they deserve the opportunity to speak to this on their own. I don't speak for them.
So where do you, if not dopamine, maybe you're getting oxytocin, which is more that connection hormone versus the pleasure hormone that dopamine is. So where do you get your pleasure these days?
I'm enjoying sitting having this conversation with you. You know where I get my pleasure from?
Yeah.
Everything meaningful in my life begins each day by not making a bet.
Yeah.
By not making a bet, I have the opportunity to help other people. I have been blessed to get married again to just an amazing human being who's my partner in life. And I have the opportunity to get up each day and make a difference in this world. That's really meaningful to me. And it's a privilege I don't take for granted. I don't take it lightly. But, you know, I work with clients around recovery from gambling disorder. A person who struggles with gambling can have the urge to gamble, but not act on it. And not acting on that urge, you want to talk about a great feeling. I didn't make a bet today.
Yeah.
And when I wake up tomorrow, you know what? I'm not going to make a bet tomorrow.
Do you still say that today after all these years?
Every day.
Every day.
Every day. Monday, April 27th, will be 12 years. That's my job. Wake up in the morning. I don't take this for granted.
Is there anything you miss about gambling?
I get that question so often.
I'm sure.
And I love to give this answer.
Okay.
How could I miss something that caused me to create such a cascade of harm and hurt so many people? So no, I don't miss anything about that, because you're not allowed in recovery to remember some happy moment and not all the misery. But I will tell you this. You know when you go to the supermarket, and in the front of the supermarket there's that claw and crane game? I don't know how much it is today, because I haven't done it for 12 years.
Yeah.
I won't play that anymore. Why? Not because it's going to send me back to a craps table. It's not. But out of respect for people out there who are struggling and haven't found help yet, I won't engage in any form of gambling. but I kind of miss the crane game. I kind of used to like to try and pull those stuffed animals out there. But then again, I didn't want one stuffed animal.
No.
I'm an addict.
You wanted the whole thing, right?
I wanted 500 stuffed animals.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Harry Levant, and we've been talking about his life, such as it was, as someone addicted to gambling. He is currently working as a therapist, an advocate, and again, director of gambling policy with the Public Health Advocacy Institute at Northeastern University. And again, if you or anyone you know is having a problem with gambling, there is this phone number, 1-800-GAMBLER. So make sure that you take advantage of the services that they do provide. I mentioned this in my introduction, but in 2018, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the ban on sports betting in most states. Today, I think most states offer some form of legalized gambling without, and you have to be 18 or 21, but it's an entirely new landscape for gambling. How has that made it harder for those people that are at risk for addiction?
So in 2018, the Supreme Court decided a case called Murphy versus the NCAA. It had actually started with Governor Christie was the original plaintiff. New Jersey wanted to bring sports gambling to Atlantic City, right, was blocked by a federal law, sued, and the Supreme Court struck down the federal law that was blocking New Jersey. It was called PASPA, the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act. This didn't legalize sports gambling. What it did was it paved the way for states to legalize it if they wanted to. In fact, Justice Alito, in the opinion, wrote that legalization of sports gambling is an important public policy consideration, and Congress remains free to regulate it. But if it doesn't, each state is free to do what it wants. So now we have 40 states, 32 of them with legalized online sports gambling. But that's not where the problem starts. The problem starts because right after that, the sports league said, and not just the leagues, the teams, the owners, the players' associations, in every sport imaginable, led by the NFL, said, we want a piece of the action too.
And a piece of the
winnings. These are the losses of the public. We want a piece of the money. And an entirely new business model was created when the NFL partnered with a company called Genius Sports. The NFL owns about 10% of this company. And what they do is they sell their real-time data to the gambling industry for billions of dollars in the aggregate. And this is where the public health crisis gets started, because you now have the leagues, the teams, the owners, the players, the AI companies, and state government itself all wanting a piece of this pie. The problem with this pie is there's only one ingredient, and that's the losses of the public. Mm. So what they've done is they've created a whole new form of gambling called micro-betting and same-game parlays, which deliver on every phone, tablet, watch, and computer constant nonstop action. For example, tonight, you could bet on the speed of every pitch in every baseball game. And the people making the money aren't just the gambling companies. It's the sports leagues. It's all driven by AI. It is machine versus human, and the people are losing. It's the most highly addictive form of gambling we've ever seen.
Well, and I've seen videos of people doing this micro betting, and the excitement. I mean, it's just nonstop. Do this, do that. What about this? What about that? And one can imagine, especially someone who is into sports, and apparently young men and even teenage boys are at greatest risk for getting hooked.
It's an epidemic. And you know, at the start of, you mentioned the excitement. Yes, that's what they show on TV. That's what they show on Instagram. I see the tears and the misery in my office. They don't show those on TV. And in your intro, you played a commercial that I use in every talk. I probably give 125 talks a year. The FanDuel commercial where the voiceover says, there's no such thing as garbage time.
Yes.
They're actually encouraging you in that commercial to bet on every moment of every game. If a bartender did that with alcohol, we would shut the bar on the spot. With gambling, it's the new business model, and it is a highly dangerous and defectively designed gambling product. That's where my advocacy work comes in.
Yeah. So you're it's the excitement, it's the sort of moment by moment something is going to happen. Uh-oh, you know, here it comes, here it comes. You better get on.
It never stops.
Right.
There is no, if you think of another good way to give an example is a basketball game. There is a shot every 24 seconds or less. There's betting on every shot. Tennis, there's a serve every 15 seconds or less. I've had the privilege to work with a few hundred people over the last 5 years or so. Not a single one of them got hooked on betting who wins or loses the game every 3 hours. Every client I see is hooked on micro betting. And this is just the people I'm seeing. How many more people are out there who are suffering, who haven't yet found help? The product is the problem, not the individual.
Is there something, though, about, I guess, young men or even teenage boys? As we know, you know, our brains are not fully developed until we're into our mid-20s. Is there something about their hormones and even their love for sports that can draw them in?
It's multiple things. I think you just hit on a number of them. First of all, you're scientifically correct. The human brain risk-reward system is not formed until you're 26. When you're 22 years old, you're supposed to think you can fly. It's part of how you learn your boundaries and limitations. But add in other things we know. We know that more and more people are having trouble with algorithms on their phones. These things are mini computers in our pocket all the time. The love of sports, whether it's the macho aspect or the competitive aspect, and respectfully, I am getting as many calls from and on behalf of women as I do men. Mm-hmm. I submit to you that there's a bit of an inappropriate cultural bias among researchers who are focused on young men. Young women enjoy sports as much as young men do,
sure.
But it's the combination of the risk-reward system, the use of technology. And if you're under the age of 30, you've never known sports and gambling to not go together. We've married them together like chocolate and peanut butter in a Reese's cup, but it's not normal. And it's those factors. But make no mistake, I have clients and patients in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. Online sports gambling and online casino gambling is a fundamentally different and more dangerous form of gambling than we've ever seen before.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, that's Harry Levant, our guest today on The Connection. We are talking about gambling and we learned a bit about his life, his descent into gambling addiction. And again, he is currently director of gambling policy with the Public Health Advocacy Institute at Northeastern University. He works as a therapist and an advocate. And we have much more to talk about after this very short break, including the fact that sports gambling, especially on phones, is just blowing up. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia, and we are talking about the problem with gambling with our guest, Harry Levant. Let me throw something else on, because I was thinking, I mean, besides online sports betting, which we've been talking about, there's, of course, Atlantic City and Las Vegas. There are lotteries. I don't know how you feel about state lotteries. And now we have these things called, you know, prediction markets. So we've got Polymarket and Kalshi betting on future events, whether it's election results or economic trends or the weather or even war strategies that people are putting bets, if I can use that with quotation marks here on the radio, on just about everything.
And Kalshi and Polymarket, the prediction market companies, and Robinhood, there are a few others. Mm. They've moved into the sports gambling space as well. And Marty, I think it's important to remind everyone, I'm not a prohibitionist. I'm not opposed to the properly regulated legalization of sports gambling. When I testified in December of 2024 before the Senate Judiciary Committee in Washington, D.C., the first thing I said is I'm in favor of properly regulated legalization. But what your question demonstrates is none of this is properly regulated. And when we talk about prediction markets, they have found an opening right now. We'll see how long the opening lasts, where they're bringing online gambling. They're calling it predictions, but you know, when something looks like a duck and it waddles like a duck and it quacks like a duck, it's a duck. Prediction markets are gambling. Gambling on sports, gambling on pop culture, horrifically gambling on life and death matters.
Yeah.
And they're delivering it now in every state of the country to people as young as 18. Public has had enough. These companies are so brazen in their tactics and acting in such contradiction of public health that we're seeing more and more. Ipsos and Siena just put out a poll that nearly 60% of the country says this is a mistake. The public is pushing back, and that's where the public health movement comes in, because we simply cannot allow these companies, Kalshi, Polymarket, Robinhood, to call it predictions and target 18-year-olds. It's simply wrong.
Are you okay with state lotteries?
State lotteries...
And they generally take money from people that can least afford it. I think we should put that out there.
We could do our own show for an hour on state lotteries. I don't want to say okay or not okay, because as I said to you, I am not a prohibitionist. The two criticisms the gambling industry tries to lob in my direction are that I'm just angry, when nothing could be further from the truth. I'm the most grateful person you're going to meet in quite a long time, and that I'm anti-gambling. Neither are true. But they answer your question briefly about lotteries. Statistically, numerically, the lottery is the single worst and most predatory form of gambling. It's also been here for more than 50 years. Yes. It's a separate conversation. I have made the decision that it is so important to address online casino and online sports gambling that we're going to reserve lottery talk for another day.
I always objected to the use of the word gaming, the gaming commission, when we're really talking about gambling. I know this is like a teeny little issue, but I just feel like if you can't say the word gambling, then you're really misrepresenting yourself to the public.
I don't think it's a teeny question at all. The AGA, the largest lobbying organization, call themselves the American Gaming Association. The incredibly flawed policy that the gambling industry puts forward, they call the responsible gaming model. Responsible gaming model is industry language for industry self-regulation. It pulls people out of a river after they're drowning. I'm leading a public health movement. The public health movement says, wait a minute, prevention is the best form of treatment. We're going to install regulations that are guardrails so people don't fall into the river in the first place, because prevention is the best form of treatment.
Do you see parallels between gambling and smoking, and also to the tobacco industry and the gambling industry?
So my mentor and the leader of the of PHAI, where I'm privileged to work, is Professor Richard Daynard from Northeastern University School of Law. Dick Daynard is one of the, if not the, recognized leader in the country of the strategy, the public health strategy that took on big tobacco. And from that, he founded PHAI, the Public Health Advocacy Institute. It is because of these parallels that Professor Daynard decided to throw the full weight of PHAI into the arena to bring public health regulation to the gambling industry. And the easiest parallel to see, in 1994, the executives, just 30 years ago, the executives of the top seven tobacco companies went in front of Congress in a hearing and said they didn't believe that tobacco and nicotine were addictive. 3 months ago, I was on national television on CNN with Bill Miller, the head of the American Gaming Association.
I hear
you. And Mr. Miller told the world on CNN that he doesn't believe that gambling is addictive. Those who forget history are doomed to repeat it, and we are not going to let the gambling industry fool the public any longer. We're not going to do it.
Do you see them, is it predatory, or that they just know about the kind of technology and methods that can hook people in? Thinking of these micro bets, you know, where you're just constantly pulled into the action.
The result is predatory. The design is intentional. And the intent is from the commissioners, whether it's Roger Goodell or Adam Silver or Gary Bettman, or Rob Manfred, commissioners of all the other major sports leagues who are profiting by selling their data. Governor Charlie Baker, who's now the president of the NCAA, recently did a deal with Genius Sports, who the NFL owns 10% of, and the NCAA is now selling March Madness basketball tournament data for micro-betting on college basketball. This is simply too much, which is why I helped write and introduce in Washington what's called the Safe Bet Act, which is designed as minimum federal safety standard. It doesn't prohibit gambling. What it does is brings common sense public health reform, and that's what the public is demanding.
Well, give us for example.
Sure. I'll tell you just a few of the common sense reforms.
Sure.
The first one is something called affordability checks. Now, affordability checks are not the government telling the public how to spend their money. No one's for that. What affordability checks are, they'd say to DraftKings and FanDuel and Fanatics and Caesars and MGM, if you want to take more than $10,000 of gambling action from a customer in a given month or $1,000 a night, you have to run an affordability check the same way a bank would before it would loan $10,000 unsecured to an individual. Because if a person doesn't have the financial means to borrow $10,000, why should they be allowed to gamble it? I routinely see in my practice college students who don't have jobs losing tens of thousands of dollars. How are we permitting people who don't have an income to gamble tens of thousands of dollars? And you know, we do affordability checks already. If you and I, this afternoon after the show, decided to go buy a car together and our budget was for a five-year-old previously owned, and we walked into that dealership and there was a shiny new convertible on the floor, we might want that convertible. We might need that convertible, but we're not going to get that convertible. There's a sales manager and a credit manager and a bank all running affordability checks. We do it when we buy products. There's no requirement for the gambling companies. They can take all the action they want, and then they put the onus back on the user and say, well, you should have just gambled responsibly. We have responsible gaming tools. It's fundamentally wrong. If I may just tell you.
Yeah, let me just pick up on that, because they do offer supposedly responsible gaming tools. I'm looking at your face while I say that. But is that how they kind of cover themselves, because they
That is how they have attempted to cover themselves and have done so quite effectively for the last 40 years. But now there is a public health movement that I am privileged to help lead. And as we talked about earlier, public health wants to prevent the problem before it occurs.
Right.
Responsible gaming, let's use a famous responsible gaming tool that the industry likes to tout, self-exclusion. Now, as a
what is that?
Self-exclusion is you can exclude yourself, so you're no longer allowed to gamble on the apps. By the time someone reaches the point of self-exclusion, the hemorrhaging and the harm that they have done to themselves and their families and their friends and their community is off the charts. Off the charts. Now, as a therapist, I will use self-exclusion sometimes as a tool to help someone if they need it, but it's after the harm has occurred. We need to prevent the harm in the first place. Self-exclusion is a gambling industry, unethical, responsible gambling tool. It is letting the harm occur and then putting the onus on the victim to say, well, you should have self-excluded. No way. No way.
I wonder, though, for people who are at risk for addiction. We live, yes, there's all this public health work that's on the way out into the public. But at the same time, there, you know, everywhere you turn around, there's another way that you can gamble, whether it is the lottery or something online or a casino.
I'm not saying that self-exclusion shouldn't be used for people who have been diagnosed and are struggling to stop. Right. What I'm saying to you, as a responsible gaming tool, it turns the world upside down. The responsibility, the onus, has to be placed on the individual, on the industry, and on the product. We need to regulate the product, the industry, and its sports partners. Let me tell you the next element of the Safe Bet Act. The Safe Bet Act bans in-game micro-betting that is developed by AI. All of these micro-bets, for example, the speed of the next pitch, are created by artificial intelligence. There are no bookmakers sitting in a smoke-filled room setting odds on the speed of every pitch. Machines are doing that, and they deliver it every 15 seconds or faster, it's fundamentally defective. It's fundamentally dangerous. So the safe bet act says people should be able to bet whatever they want before a game starts. But once a game starts, give sports back to the American family. We don't have to sit there on our phones betting on everything. Safe Bet Act puts in deposit limits. If someone is making too many deposits in a day and chasing more and more action, the Safe Bet Act has a requirement for what's called disclosure of true odds. Rather than just seeing these bright green and blue numbers of what you can win, the computer's AI has calculated what the odds against you are. So the Safe Bet Act says, fine, if someone's going to make one of those same game parlays, disclose what the odds against them are, and then give the person a chance to opt out if they want. And the Safe Bet Act says no more of these VIP host programs where there are employees of the gambling companies who target users and keep them in action by rewarding them for more play. If a bartender did that, they'd be arrested.
Right. I wonder, though, and I can understand what you're saying, especially as it applies to people who have trouble with gambling and have trouble with the possibility of getting addicted. But what is the difference between the person that can do all the stuff that you described and not have problems, and those that get hooked and lose money and lose friends and even family sometimes?
You know, it's one of the mistakes we make in this dialogue is we only seem to talk about gambling addiction. Mm-hmm. Gambling addiction is a diagnosis if you hit 4 of 9 criteria in DSM. But gambling harm happens on a continuum. We don't want to wait until people meet the criteria for addiction. The way you prevent that is you address the nature of the product, and you do with regulation what the gambling industry says they are actually here to do. You turn it back into entertainment. I'll give a simple example. I just peeked at my phone right now.
You did?
I'm
live
so sorry.
Radio?
Right. Well, you know what? Hopefully no one saw me on the radio.
I didn't see you, but no, go ahead.
But
go
I took a peek for a reason. Right now, if you wanted to, you could bet on every serve in a ping pong match from the Czech Republic. What's entertainment about that?
No.
You can't
Well, it might be for some. I'm just playing devil's advocate. It might be for somebody.
It's funny. I've met a lot of people who've suffered a lot of harm chasing action on things. Right. I've yet to meet a single one of those people tell me it was fun. Gambling can be fun for a significant number of people, but online micro betting is not designed for entertainment purposes. Right. It's designed to deliver constant action. Absolutely, people should be able to gamble. I'm for it. I can't do it, but people who can do it for entertainment should. But micro betting is not about entertainment. Think of it in terms of alcohol, enjoying a glass of wine socially.
Right.
If the bartender was encouraging you to finish that drink faster and now have another and another and another, would you even contemplate describing that as entertaining or social?
We're almost out of time here, but I wonder, do you think casinos have cleaned up gambling when it's either Atlantic City or Las Vegas, the two big meccas?
All of the casinos are now, certainly in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, are partnering with the online operators. It's not a matter of cleaned up. Gambling's not dirty. And people who gamble aren't dirty.
Right.
It's a matter of the way in which this industry has been permitted to behave in disregard of public health because it's not properly regulated. We can fix this. The Safe Bet Act can fix it, and state legislation can fix it. And that's what I'm out there trying to do, because I treat people. I'm a clinician, and I love treating people. But if I'm going to do that, I have a moral obligation to also try and put my therapy practice out of business by trying to make it safer. That's what I'm about. Let's make it fun and safe for people to enjoy. That's the public health approach.
What do you love about treating people?
The look in someone's eye when they move from hopelessness to just a little bit of hope. When people find their way to me, they are hopeless. And to anybody listening to this, don't be hopeless. Mm-hmm. Just give us that one little percent of hope by saying, I need help. And when I see that look in someone's eye and they realize, you know what? There is hope. I can do this. That's the greatest moment.
Do you see yourself in your clients?
You can't do that. Every good therapist has a good therapist. You have to make sure you bracket. You have to be, these journeys belong to my clients. Do my clients benefit from the fact that I know what they've been going through? Sure. But this is their journey, not mine. I'm just there as a guide.
And do you enjoy sports?
I do now, but not the same. Sports have become the equivalent of a nonstop slot machine. They've gone too far with this. And what I'm hoping happens is I think there are athletes with social conscience who are going to hear this and say, hey, wait a minute, we ought to become part of the public health movement.
We got to leave it there. Harry Levant, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
To be continued.
To be continued. And again, he is Director of Gambling Policy with the Public Health Advocacy Institute at Northeastern University. He told us a bit about his life. He works now as a therapist and an advocate. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Al Banks has been our engineer. Debbie Builder produces the show with help today from Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.